It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 102 for Friday, the 23rd of November, 2012. This week, human rights groups call for a preemptive ban on killer robots. European missions to Mars get a jolly old twin pair of thumbs up from the international decision makers. Rhinos get protection from poachers courtesy of the South African army. And I have a considerable rant to make about the BBC's decision to axe a popular science radio programme. All that and more coming up. Ahoy hoy, Nate Langston here. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. My microphone has just gotten significantly louder in my own headphones. And joining me for this celebration of loudness is Olivia Solon.
Hello. You didn't say underscore.
It's because we've done 102 episodes.
Is it over?
Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
And David Cornish.
Hi there.
How's everyone feeling?
Yeah, pretty good.
Good.
I'm very glad. I've had about 9 pints of tea today, so I'm buzzing like a, you know, like a bee that's
bee.
Just, yeah.
Bee that's on cocaine.
Perhaps. Bees are not the subject of our show today, but the first thing that is the topic of killer robots and specifically how they should be banned, David.
Yeah, they darn well should be banned.
Let's get straight into this news.
Yeah, on the 19th of November, Human Rights Watch and International Human Rights Clinic, two human rights groups, they published a 50-page report entitled Losing Humanity, The Case Against Killer Robots. The report essentially outlines the human rights group's concerns over the development of fully autonomous weapons, as they believe that the creation of killer robots could have serious implications for the current legal and non-legal checks regarding the killing of civilians in warfare.
These killer robots, though, these autonomous weapons don't actually exist, though, now, do they?
Not
this
as
is, like,
of yet. No.
Hypothetical future-facing stuff.
Yes, though what their report outlines is that we are very much on a track towards a point where autonomous weapons might really exist in the next few years. They even start quoting the US military and the UK military on when they think those might turn up. And there's variation on it, but it's between 12 to 30 years' time they could emerge. So basically, yeah, they point to various different precursors that will lead to autonomous weapons, like they list the Israeli Iron Dome system. So that's a system that helps shoot down missiles coming into Israel, which they say that that's it's a human on-the-loop weapon that they are. They list. There's another thing called the SGR S1 Sentry robot, which is on the border of South Korea and other places, which if anyone ever pops up and tries to cross the border, this robot with his big artillery guns will pop up, look at it, and send a report to anybody sitting at the control and say, do we take this guy out or should we let him through?
Yeah, but it still has that kill switch. It still sends it
moment,
to a human operator who has to make
precisely.
That final call.
Yeah.
It is like something out of Terminator.
It really is. So losing humanity, the report recognises that there's very much a laudable use of technology to have in the theatre of war when it's used to remove soldiers from the line of fire. It just fears that creating fully autonomous weapons or human out-of-the-loop weapons, so you literally set this robot off, it designates its own targets and delivers its own kill orders, they think that that's a step too far.
Mm.
So a robot specifically wouldn't be able to comply with the current international humanitarian laws on rules of distinction, proportionality, and military necessity.
And yeah, so you have to have human responsibility in warfare, don't you? Otherwise, no one can be held to account when people have in breach of the laws of war.
Yeah, international. Well, all the Geneva Convention and any other form of international humanitarian law. The report suggests that full autonomy would strip civilians of protections from the effects of war that are guaranteed under the current laws.
Yeah,
and the key word here really is killer robots. I mean, it sounds like it sounds quite funny to say killer robots because we've seen such things in movies for decades. But this is specifically focusing on machines that have the power to judge and kill, as opposed to, say, my Roomba, which is fully autonomous to a certain extent, and it just goes around my floor and vacs up. It doesn't.
Yeah.
It's not affecting robots like that. This
no.
is specifically ones that, as you describe, pop up, judge if you're a terrorist, and shoot you in the head.
Specifically,
but
that.
But they're not actually. I mean, the way we're talking about it, it sounds almost like they're these kind of actually look like people, but in robot form. They're not that. They're generally things like drone aeroplanes that have missiles attached to them and cameras and can scan for people, or some kind of tank-like vehicle that could travel all these sentries. They're more just like kind of big machine guns that just happen to have camera tracking attached to them.
So the Human Rights Watch, both of these groups, they basically want an international treaty to prohibit the development of these fully autonomous killing machines.
Yes, that's exactly what they're looking for. They've basically outlined the risks involved. It's a very interesting report, only 50 pages, and it's written very nice. It's not too dense. You can give it a good read if you're interested on the subject. They want to have an international treaty and various laws in place that will prohibit the development, the production, and the use of any fully autonomous weapons. They don't want to get to a position where you find in any kind of like international humanitarian court where you're in a position where, is it an algorithm that's on trial? Is it the developer that's on trial? Is it the person who built the robot, their engineer? Like, they don't want to reach a position where it's very hazy as to who is actually in control of these systems.
But I think you can liken this as a problem that we already have now. I mean, one of the problems with, say, online piracy that we've had in the past, I know it's slightly tangential to killing robots, but the problem is people get sued and targeted based on their IP address and their account. And so the question has been, is it the person who owns the account's fault that somebody maybe logged into their Wi-Fi and pirated music? Or do we have to have a better system in place that more closely identifies the people actually performing the piracy as opposed to the people who simply enable it? And I think that this is sort of a more extreme example of that in terms of, you know, ethics.
There's a kind of slightly closer, I think, example with autonomous vehicles going on at the moment in terms of insurance companies. At the moment, a person gets an insurance policy for driving a car, but as cars become more and more autonomous, if a car is fully autonomous, who's responsible if it crashes? I mean, the likelihood is it's much less likely to crash if it's fully autonomous, according to studies. But if it does and the human is not in control of the vehicle, is it then the manufacturer's fault?
Within this story, though, there is that interesting ethical question of whether this use of technology, are we happy to see it used in warfare? Should we allow tech to make war easier?
I think the answer
to that
is...
Well, we've done that throughout the years, of course.
Yeah.
Well, otherwise we'd all be fighting with clubs and bows and arrows.
But in the sense of, now we're getting to a point where we are trying to remove humans from the act of warfare.
Yeah, but you know, that's just a modern version of which countries were it that sort of objected to the use of guns and gunpowder because they thought, it's cheating and this can only be fought on the battlefield with, you know, with bows
sabers
and arrows and swords because using gunpowder and things like that, it's cheating. Mm. I'm not completely clear on the history, but I know there'll be many people listening who'll be shouting at their headphones thinking, it was this. We've gone on long enough about this, though, I think. Let us move on. Podcast at wired.co.uk, of course, if you have views, let us know. Liv, there was a dude who had a 135-hour gaming marathon and broke records as a result.
Yes.
You've been doing a Q&A.
Well, I spoke to this guy. Slightly unhinged, I think.
He is.
A guy called Okan Kaya. He started gaming on the 13th of November. He was playing Call of Duty Black Ops 2.
Of course he was.
And 135 hours and 50 minutes later, he stopped playing. And in that time, he smashed the Guinness World Record for the longest gaming marathon, which had previously been held by two Canadians. And they clocked up 121 hours.
And there's a slight caveat to this, which kind of bugged me a little bit when I was reading this story after we published it, which is that he was allowed to build up several hours of sleep.
Yeah, well, under the Guinness regulations, you're allowed to have a 10-minute break for every hour. I think this is to prevent people from dying, basically. There have been cases in the past where people have played continuously, not eaten, not slept, and they've suffered serious health consequences. And in one case in Korea, someone actually died.
Yeah, and that was only after 40 hours.
Yeah, so what they did, they said you can have 10 minutes break, you know, to go to the loo, eat some food, whatever, but you're allowed to stockpile these. So what he did was he kind of added up all his breaks, and he took a few longer breaks of about, I think the longest he ever took was 2 hours, and he slept for 3 hours, and he slept during the night so he could wake up and kind of start again semi-refreshed.
David, do you think that's cheating?
You definitely need the asterisks on the 135 hours. Because that leads you to think that this guy's gone through severe deprivation to get that record.
Well, he did. He stood at it's more than 5 days, and he had the maximum amount of sleep he had in any of one of those nights was 3 hours. I think it's still pretty impressive.
It's definitely a feat of endurance.
I suppose the person who previously had this record had the same option. Yeah. And so, relatively speaking, he's still done more than the previous people.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. But so, what I like is how he kind of came about to doing the record in the first place. I think in 2010, his wife bought him the book of Guinness World Records, and he kind of went through it, trying to see, as I've done before, actually, of which records he could potentially seize. At the time, the record was only 40 or 50 hours, I think, for the longest ever gaming marathon, possibly held by that guy who popped his clogs.
I've probably beaten that in the past.
And so he said, I really want to do this someday. And then eventually he had a very understanding boss at his company for cabling in Sydney. And they said, well, let's make this a bit of a thing. We'll kind of incorporate a sort of a PR stunt and let you do this and we'll live stream it. And so he did. But when I spoke to him, well, interviewed him, so I quite liked some of the techniques he used to kind of stay focused. Like, he didn't, you'd think he'd be just like mainlining coffee and Red Bull, but he said that people he'd spoken to about kind of keeping, you know, having this endurance suggested not to do that. So he only had three cans of Red Bull, but lots of iced water, because apparently that's very good. And he actually had a kind of exercise program as well that he did while playing the game, which I quite liked, just to keep his kind of blood flow going. But by the end of the 135 hours, he was actually the 29th player, ranked 29th in the whole world of 5.1 million players of Coblops. And he still wants to play more.
That's impressive.
It's dedicated.
Yeah.
I mean, what's your record? You guys are fairly.
Well, I put 180 hours into Fallout 3. But that wasn't in one go. That was over the period of, you know, a few weeks, probably 3 or 4 weeks. I think the longest I've done in one sitting would probably be, I guess, between about 12 and 16 hours.
Yeah. And did you experience any side effects from that?
Not during the gaming. It's just when you go outside and everything looks, you know, kind of surreal relative to what you've spent your previous several hours experiencing. You know, things do get a bit, they do sort of nights and day blur into one.
Yeah.
Mine, I recall from when back in the day when you didn't actually used to be able to save games. So on my old Sega Mega Drive, I once had a day off school because I was sick. And so I had a day where I was sitting around doing nothing. So I completed Sonic and Knuckles, which took about like 8 hours. I was only little. But yeah, those were the days when games, you really did have to be like, right, I'm not doing anything today. I'm going to try and complete my favourite game.
If you're well enough to be playing video games, you are well enough to be at school. That's what my mum would have told me.
I know.
How much time have you wasted in your life? Let us know, podcast@wired.co.uk. The European Space Agency's member nations have prioritised a mission to Mars over a mission to the moon. Proposals for a lunar landing were abandoned due to lack of support at recent negotiation between European Space and Agency member states. A trip to Mars garnered favourable reception. Sorry, I'm scrambling all of my words today. It's all this talk of playing video games.
Having a moment of lunacy.
Oh, lovely.
Very good.
Why was Mars deemed to be more important than the moon?
It's where all the cool kids go.
Well, the thing, ESA has this program called ExoMars, for one thing, which was originally going to be a collaboration with NASA, but NASA axed its support and withdrew from the project. And so ESA is going to be working with the Russian agency, Roscosmos.
Okay.
And so they're hoping to be plonking a rover onto the Red Planet by 2018 or in 2018 and going to have a small stationary lander a couple of years earlier, hopefully in 2016. Okay. And I think really that, you know, Mars is more attractive for a lot of people, I think, than the moon, because, you know, we often think that somewhere like Mars is the kind of place that we could in the future perhaps terraform and move to. Interesting stuff. I think you'll agree, David.
I do indeed.
I thought you might. Let's talk about rhinoceri.
The South African army has been sent to its borders with Swaziland Swaziland and Mozambique in order to help stop a rhino poaching crisis that's been gripping the nation there.
Because hundreds of rhinos get killed every year, don't they?
Yeah, 570 this year alone have been killed in South Africa, with 8 rhinos killed last weekend at a game reserve in the northwest province of South Africa.
And this is of a population of just 20,000 rhinos that are left in the whole of South Africa.
South Africa has 90% of all of the rhinos in Africa. Mm. There's 2 species in South Africa, the white and the black rhino. Yeah. And I think there's only 5 species in the whole of Africa, the whole of the continent. And so, yeah, there's a lot of numbers of rhinos there. So poachers are drawn there by the huge value of the rhino's horns, which can be sold for around £40,000 per kilo, which is more than the current price of gold, which in the UK is £35,000. Much of the demand for the rhino horns comes from the traditional medicine markets of countries like China and Vietnam, where, really unfortunate, there's no clinical evidence that rhino horns help anybody or have any kind of properties that work, but because it's in the...
And there have been some rumours that recently in the last few years, particularly I think in Vietnam, it was rumoured that a politician cured his cancer by ingesting ground-up rhino horn. And no one can quite trace this rumour, but it seems to have been credited with triggering a kind of lot of demand for rhino horn in Vietnam and surrounding countries.
So what has the army done to help put a stop to this?
Well, basically, the army's involvement, they're there because it's been felt that the conservation bodies that work in the game reserves have neither the resources nor really the skills required to stop the poachers. I mean, if you're a bunch of conservationists, you don't really have the manpower or potentially know what your legal rights are for going up to a bunch of guys who turn up with guns and Land Rover and say, excuse me, can you stop killing our rhinos? It's, you know, it's not a nice position to find yourself in. So it was announced that the army's involvement was announced by the chief executive officer of a conservation organisation, Ezemvelo, KZN, a guy called Bandil Mikis. He's announced that the army are getting involved, and this organisation has proposed to plan for a highly specialised task force that can be deployed to stop the poachers at their hotspots, and it's going to draw on intelligence from the area rather than being a reactive thing. So they don't want these task force to suddenly like go out with the lights blazing as soon as they hear a shot in the distance. They want to be there and know what's going to happen before it happens. So they're going to be using helicopters and land cruisers to be able to get to patrol these kind of areas.
This is great. This is great. We should be doing more to like this to protect rhinoceros and other endangered animals. More so than pandas, in my opinion.
Yeah.
We've ranted about pandas in the past.
Well,
that's fantastic. Also, we've got another story actually this week that has a similar sort of sad undertone to it, which is that great apes suffer similar midlife crises to humans, according to a study this week, Liv.
Yeah, so...
sad chimps. Yeah. Oh, it's not chimps, is it? It's orangutans.
Well, it's orangutans and chimps, actually, that have been studied. This is a psychologist at Edinburgh University called Alexander Weiss, I'm going to say. Maybe it's Wise. I don't know if it's a German pronunciation. But he's been looking at great apes and whether they also have a midlife crisis that has been fairly well documented in humans by psychologists in terms of showing kind of a U-shape in happiness throughout someone's life cycle. So you start life very happy, and then between the ages of 45 and 50, you're much more likely to commit suicide or use antidepressants or generally report as being happy in your career or life, all the various different metrics they use to measure this. And then as you get older, you get happier again. Alexander and his colleagues wanted to see whether there was a chance that it was an evolutionary thing as opposed to kind of more of an environmental issues and challenges that people face in their life. And so they had to devise a test to examine happiness in orangutans and chimpanzees.
And this fascinates me because, you know, chimps and orangutans don't tend to have, you know, careers that they get stuck into. They don't have children that they don't want to let go of. Actually, that's not true. They do.
They do.
But they certainly don't have, you know, crippling career depression.
No, and they also can't tell you how they're feeling. So it's quite a challenge, I guess, for them to measure this. But what they did was they asked the keepers. So again, this is also in captivity. So that's something, probably a factor we need to consider, the fact that these are animals, they're not in the wild in their regular habitat. But they had to ask the keepers if an animal animal on a daily basis was in a good mood, how much it was interacting socially, and whether it was achieving its goals, whatever those goals might be.
Kevin normally spends 2 hours on the tyre swing. He's only spent 5 minutes on it today.
Exactly. Yeah.
This little fellow, Terry, has thrown 14 piles of dung at his friends. That's a bad sign.
That's a bad sign. So they examined them, and they found actually that there was a similar clear U-shaped trend from the samples that they examined. And there was three separate samples across around the world at different sanctuaries. And there was found that between the ages of 28 and 35, which is the midlife for these animals, they had their kind of a nadir in terms of happiness. Aww. So they were least happy then. And then they improved later.
Did they buy little monkey motorbikes and supercars to cheer themselves back
up?
Not
that I'm aware of, but perhaps they should have considered something along those lines.
So what does it suggest, though? I mean, as interesting as this is it useful to know?
Well, what Weiss thinks is that we should be taking a bit more of a cross-species approach to understanding human well-being. It's not something we've done in the past. You know, psychology is very much generally seen as a human study. And so he's suggesting that we could perhaps understand the human psyche better if we could look back into orangutans and chimpanzees.
I suppose there are likenesses between being in a zoo and being in some companies.
Yes.
You know, in terms of a repetitive environment you're in day to day, that you perhaps feel trapped in, regular breaks and intervals. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's probably not so. I mean, we don't have any, tyre swings in our office. We all seem fairly chirpy, but we're not necessarily a representative.
No salt licks, no straw. No. I mean, actually, I'm feeling a bit deprived at the moment right now.
Yeah, I don't remember the last time I had a swim in a penguin pool. Well, we're going to swim in an ad break right now, but when we jump out and dry ourselves off, we're going to discuss why the BBC is so wrong to kill naked scientists.
The naked scientists.
It's wrong to kill naked scientists.
Well, it's also wrong, but it hasn't done that.
No, it hasn't. But it would be wrong. Would be wrong for me to kill naked scientists.
It would be wrong for
all of
us.
Wired magazine. Now available every month on Amazon Kindle Fire, selected Android tablets, as well as the full range of iPads. From Retina display down to the iPad mini. Don't miss out. Subscribe today at wired.co.uk/magazine.
Welcome back. Now, Liv and David, let me ask you a question. Do you think that being of international scientific intrigue would negate a topic's relevance to listeners of regional radio stations?
Definitely not.
No?
No.
Okay. A rational person, I think, would agree with you. But the BBC is going to axe a very popular radio program called The Naked Scientists because apparently science isn't appropriate for local radio.
So this is not because they haven't been getting viewers or listeners, rather.
No.
Not because of any kind of budget. Well, there are budgetary constraints to the BBC, but not any particular ones relating to this show.
This show, I mean, I wanted to flag this up and show a bit of support for fellow podcasters and fellow people who try and disseminate, you know, authoritative scientific information, if you like, into the public hive mind.
Yeah.
And this show in particular is one that I'm a fan of. And
for people who haven't heard it, what's the kind of show topic? What does it talk
well,
about?
Well, the show, it's an hour once a week. It goes out as a podcast after it's been on local radio. They discuss, generally have a topic that's a theme for the week, such as cancer development or genetics or neuroscience or things that actually have a very wide rate of relevance to the public.
Yeah.
And interspersed, they'll, you know, they have live phone-ins and people can call in with questions. And unlike a lot of, say newspaper reports or television programs or whatever, you know, it is a two-way thing. And the hosts are scientists. They're from medical scientific backgrounds or particular backgrounds of scientific expertise. And they often get in experts from people in the field, from people writing studies, as opposed to just commentating them from like an armchair perspective.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's a very useful program, both educationally and also I think scientifically, because it, you know, this is scientists doing the journalism, which I think particularly in the scientific faculties is incredibly important if you want to get deep into some of these topics. So but the show itself pays the chap who heads it up £40 an episode, so we're not talking about budgetary cuts here that the BBC is trying to, and you know, rightly so, cut in certain areas to make room for other programming. You know, that's wise, but that's not why this is being killed.
But this isn't an area where it's hemorrhaging cash, is it?
This is being axed because the relevance is deemed not high enough for a local audience. It's more of a national or international program, at least according to the people making these decisions. And I think that is wrong, because scientific research, particularly when we're talking about topics like health, well-being, and things like that, these are important to a person in Norfolk, let's say, as they are to us here in London, as they are to somebody in Mozambique or Antarctica in a research lab or whatever. So the geographic location of this kind of conversation, should be important.
But are they not saying, oh, it's so important that we're going to give it a platform on a national radio station? They're just cutting it all together.
It's being cut all together. And I just think that this is a real shame. And I wanted to raise some awareness because obviously we are just a podcast. We're not a radio show. But we have thousands and thousands and thousands of listeners every single week. And I just wanted to sort of raise this as this is a thing that's happening. And I don't think it should happen. I think there are significant ramifications that axing a show like Naked Scientists has, which is, I mean, it sends an awful message to aspiring scientific students and journalists. And I mean, the BBC Eastern Region, for example, covers areas, universities, important universities, companies like Arm or Illumina, and they do some amazing genetic research. To remove a popular program that doesn't cost much money and that disseminates information to, you know, on a very wide range of topics and of great public interest, I just think it seems illogical. I don't think this is the right thing to do. Yeah. And I think particularly we are in an era where anyone with a keyboard and opinion can basically get that opinion out to homes around the world. And we need people and shows like this that can put out scientifically sound, reasoned and balanced information in a way that can be both entertaining and informative.
Yeah.
And I think that whether that's in a local context that has broad public appeal or whether it's a national program, I don't think that's important. Yeah. I think this is a real shame. So, plus the show is terrific. I know about this because I listen to the show and I just think I think we need to stand up and say that's wrong.
Yeah.
And we should send a message to the BBC.
The show is still available as a podcast. So it's not completely disappearing off the face of the earth.
No, and I spoke to one of the Chris, who's the guy who started the podcast, Chris Smith, who's a medical doctor at Cambridge University, and you know he has said that it could theoretically continue as a podcast, but one of the things that makes this show particularly interesting and I suppose unique in a certain context is the fact that they're doing it live. People can phone in with questions.
Yeah.
It's very much a community type feeling to the show that allows people to, you know, get questions, get answers, send questions in, and get them answered in a way that is actually useful as opposed to, you know.
So what can people do to express their dissatisfaction with the fact that it's been axed?
Well, I think people can go to the Naked Scientists website. If you Google it, look it up and have a look at some stuff they've posted there. And, you know, only if you agree. I mean, we have nothing to do with them, you know, for anything other than we just don't like the decision of the BBC. And we think it sends a bad message out to the scientific and journalistic communities. But if you do think that this is bad and you're interested in learning more and perhaps sending a message to the BBC or something, then their website is where you can find that. And of course, if you don't agree, then our comments are also open for reasons why you might think that this is actually a good idea. You know, we're on the fence in that sense. So by all means, do let us know. But anyway, we are going to wrap up the show at this point. Liv, tell people how they can get in touch with our podcast and our hosts.
Well, first of all, you can email us, podcast@y.co.uk. But we are also available on Twitter and we will try to respond to every tweet. We're on @WiredUK and we've got a Facebook page, facebook.com/WiredUK.
David, you do a lot on that Facebook page, don't you?
I do.
You post stuff on there.
I do. I throw up things that I think will be interesting and will entertain over your lunch break or breakfast.
Get closer to David Cornish.
Yeah.
facebook.com/WiredUK.
I need more friends.
Yeah. And I think we will see you next week.
Bye.
See ya.
I feel like a giant in Tokyo.
I bet.